Fear took down the winged life, the winged life we've led. So kiss the joy as it goes by.
The second claim I would make is that it's probable that there are no mass movements likely to emerge in the next decade in the United States that will force leaders or institutions to face these questions. A lot of people in the United States think that until conditions in the privileged societies get dramatically worse, people are going to be almost paralyzed, stuck in the inertia that comes from that privilege.
That is a controversial professor of journalism at the University of Texas, Austin, Robert Jensen. Is he right? Is the day of mass movements over? This is Radio EcoShock. I'm your host and recording artist, Alex Smith. The illusions of Wall Street are tumbling down. We all wait to see whether we are left with any money in our bank accounts or if the bank doors will open at all. What better time to hear a speech I recorded August 8, 2008 in Vancouver with the title, The Old Future's Gone. This speech has already gone ballistic on the internet as the audio for Robert Jensen's groundbreaking proposals. Radio EcoShock was listed on the front pages of both Alternet and ZNet in the same week. Parts of the speech were run last week on the Underground Network program Unwelcome Guest. Downloads from our site are in the thousands. Robert Jensen has been working on feminist issues and pornography for years. He came to international attention just days after 9/11, writing an op-ed in the Houston Chronicle. He said the U.S. was just as guilty as the hijackers. The attack on the World Trade Center and the Pentagon, Jensen wrote, quote, was no more despicable than the massive acts of terrorism that the U.S. government has committed during my lifetime, end quote. Jensen was savaged by the mainstream press and later denounced his own statements, yet he continues to prod our assumptions about society in the most sensitive places. After releasing today's speech, Jensen renamed it The Delusion Revolution. We're on the road to extinction and in denial. It's hard to argue with that, and yet I don't totally agree with him. Robert Jensen wouldn't want me to. He wants us to think and rethink our whole situation. You'll hear the whole speech, the song that inspired The Old Future's Gone, and some of the reaction from the tight group of activists who attended the release at Simon Fraser University downtown in Vancouver, Canada.
'Cause the old future's gone, the old future's gone. We can't get to there from here.
You know the model. The public dreams, protests, fills the streets, and the government changes course. Why did this fail to stop the Iraq war? Is the day of mass movements over? In the shadows of doubt and the razor of reality, you are about to hear Dr. Robert Jensen, author, Texas journalism professor, and well-known commentator. His topic is The Old Future's Gone, Progressive Politics in Cascading Crises, and the Struggle for Strategy. It was delivered to a select crowd of activists in Vancouver, Canada, on August 11, 2008. If you missed it, download the speech and the question and answer period as free MP3s in the speeches section of ecoshock.org or from radioforall.net. Here is Dr. Jensen.
I want to highlight the introduction's use of the term multifaceted, which is a synonym for we're not exactly sure what he does, what he knows, or why he's here. But that's what kind of, I think, multifaceted means. I am going to read a talk, I think in part because the radio folks are here, and it will keep me on track, because a lot of what I want to talk about is rather new. Let me say a bit about myself so you have some sense of where I come from. I started my career after college as a journalist, and I worked for about 10 years in the corporate commercial press in the United States. So I come to this with some experience as an observer in a very traditional sense. After that, I abandoned corporate journalism and went back to graduate school to train to become a university professor, and I spent about a decade doing the traditional kind of academic game graduate school research to get tenure and permanent employment, at which time I abandoned the more academic aspects of that job and really threw myself into political organizing, mostly at the local level in Austin, Texas, where I live. So I come at this with a base in journalism, in the academy, and in local left feminist organizing. And I think that kind of sums up who I am, gives you some idea of where I might be going. Also, this is very much, for me, a talk about questions around political organizing in the first world among relatively privileged people, of which I sit at the top of the pile. I am white, I am male, I'm educated with a professional job, and I live in the United States. As one of my best friends reminds me, if I'd been born good-looking, I would have had it all. So I think through these questions in terms of organizing in communities where I live, which at this point is Austin, Texas, in the most privileged part of the world. These are reflections about working in that context. There are, of course, other contexts in which people work politically. Before I start reading, I was reflecting on one moment where I think a lot of these issues can be crystallized. I don't know where you all were on February 15th, 2003, but that was the Worldwide Day of Action during the run-up to the Iraq War. And I was in Austin, Texas, where I had been part of anti-war, anti-empire organizing for a number of years and had been involved in a number of demonstrations. We always have them in front of the state capitol. And I was very good at being the MC for demonstrations with 28 people, which was about the crowd we would usually draw, right, when we were doing work on the Iraq embargo or Kosovo or whatever it was. And so it was really striking on February 15th, 2003, because I showed up there and was going to MC that, and I looked out at more people than I knew would have ever shown up for a demonstration in Austin, Texas. We estimated there were about 10,000 people. Folks in Austin said it was the largest political gathering since the Vietnam War days. I still remember the speaker system we had only reached about halfway back. I mean, half the audience didn't even hear what we were saying from the stage. They seemed quite pleased with that, quite frankly, but the way political speeches tend to go, that's not surprising. But that was 10,000 people. Worldwide, the estimates are somewhere from 10 to 15 million people came out on that day. It was the largest coordinated day of political activity in the history of the world, and it had exactly zero effect on the course of politics. And I think I want to start there just to let that settle in. Using the internet, using sophisticated communication technology, using networks that had been developed through other issues, we were able to put into the street 10 to 15 million people, hundreds of thousands of people in major cities in the United States, even 10,000 people in a little town like Austin, Texas, and it had exactly zero effect. So what does that tell us about the state of politics that we are coping with? I'm not going to provide necessarily a direct answer to that, but I think that's always in the background for me. That's a very important moment. It was an exciting moment. I was, you know, sort of up the whole day. And at the same time, I was depressed the whole day because somewhere in the back of my mind, I knew it wasn't going to make a difference. And I think that's the nature of the struggle we're in. So this talk is titled The Old Future's Gone, Progressive Politics and the Search for Strategy Amid Cascading Crises. You see already I have a preference for alliteration. I used to write headlines for a living, so this is an occupational disease. The title, The Old Future's Gone, is something I've been thinking about ever since I first heard a song in 2003 by a singer-songwriter in the United States named John Gorka. And the title, the song is called Old Future, and the lyric is, "The old future's gone. We can't get to there from here." And that always stuck with me, the old future. And I think that insight is worth some reflection. And what I want to argue tonight is the way in which we humans have long imagined the future has to be rethought as the scope and the depth of these cascading crises we face become painfully clearer. In other words, what I'm going to argue is we're in trouble. We're in trouble on all fronts, and the trouble is wider and deeper than most of us have ever been willing to acknowledge. We should struggle to find a road that might take us through those troubles, if such a road is possible, but I doubt it's going to look like any path we had previously envisioned, nor is it likely to lead to where most of us thought we were going. So whatever one's conception of the future, I'm suggesting that we should reevaluate the assumptions on which those conceptions have been based. This is a moment, I think, in which we have to abandon any political certainties to which we may want to cling. Given human beings' failure to predict the place we are today, I don't really think that's such a radical statement. The fact is we stand on the edge of the ability of the ecosystem in which we live to sustain human life as we know it. And what kind of hubris would it take to make claims that we can know the future? Well, it takes the hubris of someone like biologist Richard Dawkins, author of the popular book, The God Delusion. This is a quote from an earlier work of his in which he wrote, quote, "Our brains are big enough to see into the future and plot long-term consequences." Well, I would argue such a statement is an indication that human egos tend to be considerably bigger than human brains, and it's a reminder of the need for humility. I first heard that statement of Dawkins in a talk by Wes Jackson, who is probably my favorite scientist and, in a sense, philosopher these days. If you take nothing else away from this talk, take away the name Wes Jackson and the Land Institute, which is a research facility he co-founded doing work on sustainable agriculture. And Jackson is a scientist. He's a plant geneticist by training. But he's also, I think, an important philosopher. And one of the things he's been developing is, in a sense, a very obvious and important truth that we ignore too often, which is that for all of our cleverness, human beings are far more ignorant than we are knowledgeable. That is, we're kind of easily seduced by the accomplishments of human beings, you know, skyscrapers, the internet, we can map the human genome. And it leads us to this illusion that we have control over a world that is far more complex than we have the ability to really understand. So Jackson suggests we would be wise to recognize this fundamental state and commit to what he calls an ignorance-based worldview that would anchor us in the intellectual humility that is going to be needed if we're going to survive the more toxic effects of our own cleverness. So in a political context, let's think about, you know, these clever claims that have been made about the future. Is there anyone in the room who wants to accept the neoliberal claim that the triumph of corporate capitalism in electoral democracies is the so-called end of history, and that all that's left is to tinker with these systems to produce the good society? That was a claim made about the future. I don't know if there's anyone in the room who would want to defend the notion of so-called scientific socialism that would not only explain all of recent history, but plot out the glorious future before us. And I seriously doubt there's anyone who here wants to defend the notion that the return of the Messiah is going to give us all a first-class ticket to the New Jerusalem, at least those who believe. To reject those, what I would call very desperate attempts to secure the future, is not to suggest that there's no value in any of those schools of thought, nor is it to argue that there's nothing we can know and that we shouldn't use our knowledge to guide action. Instead, what I'm suggesting is that we recognize the limits of human intelligence, and I'm arguing that would be realistic. And by realistic, I mean that we avoid the instinct to make plans based on the world we wish existed and deal with the world as it does exist. And from there, I would want to go forward and argue that being realistic means being radical. Now, so what do I mean by sort of being realistically radical? Well, imagine you're on a train and you're riding quite comfortably in perhaps the club car of the train, and you look up ahead and you see that the tracks suddenly end quite abruptly, and you recognize that if the train continues at its pace, it will derail if you continue to move forward. So you suggest that the train stop, that the passengers disembark, that you evaluate the situation and perhaps consider going forward on foot. Now, that would require a major shift in the way people are traveling and living, but it does seem to be the only realistic option at that point, because to go forward would be to court disaster. So if you propose this course of action, but others who had also grown quite comfortable riding on the train said to you, well, we like the train, and so arguing that we should get off isn't realistic. What would you say to that claim that you aren't being realistic? Well, I think at least in the United States, I won't speak for Canada, but in the contemporary U.S., we're trapped in a very similar delusion. We're told that it is realistic to capitulate to what I would consider a thoroughly absurd idea that the systems we live in are the only systems possible because some people seem to like them and wish that they would continue. So what if real democracy is not possible in a nation of 300 million people? Well, that's too bad, because the only realistic options are those that take that way of organizing a polity as immutable. What if our current level of first world consumption is exhausting the ecological basis of life? Well, it's too bad. The only realistic options are one that take that lifestyle as non-negotiable. What if the hierarchies on which our lives are based are producing extreme material deprivation in much of the world and a kind of dull misery among many of the privileged? Well, too bad, because the only realistic options are those that take hierarchy in human societies as inevitable. So I want to offer a different view of reality with two claims. Number one, we live in a system that, taken as a whole, is unsustainable, not only over the long haul, but now also in the near term. And number two, unsustainable systems can't be sustained. Now, that's my profound theoretical insight. You might want to write that down. That's a very important my own theory. Unsustainable systems can't be sustained. Now, okay, that's hard to argue with. The real question, of course, is whether or not we do live in a system that is, in fact, unsustainable. And I don't think there's any way to prove that definitively, but I think we can just take a minute and ask ourselves, look around, for instance, in the Simon Fraser University Harbor Center building, and ask if you can imagine a world like this going forward into the indefinite future, or even for more than a few decades. If we take a minute to consider the end of the era of cheap fossil energy, the lack of any viable large-scale replacements for that energy, and the ecological consequences of burning what remains of it, if we ponder the indicators of the health of the planet, things like groundwater contamination, topsoil loss, the level of toxicity that's all around us, and if you factor into those realities the widening inequality in the world, the intensity of the violence in the world, and the desperation that so many people feel at every level, think about all of that for a moment. Right? And based on whatever you know personally about those issues, do you think that is a sustainable system? When we take a moment to let all of that kind of wash over us, does it feel like a sustainable system? If we can sort of let go of our attachments to the world, can you imagine that is a sustainable system? Right? In other words, all of the ways we perceive the world, it seems to me, tell us, in fact, that there is nothing sustainable about this world. So to be honestly realistic in the face of all of this is to recognize the failure of basic systems and to abandon the notion that all we have to do is recalibrate or reconfigure these institutions. So this is what I mean by the old future, the way we thought about the future, the way we thought things might work out. It is gone. That old future, I think John Gorka was right, is gone. The nation state and capitalism are the core of that system, and they have given rise to a high-energy mass consumption world in privileged societies that have left us saddled with what an interesting author, James Howard Kunstler, not someone I agree with on all counts, but I think he has appropriately called that a living arrangement with no future. The future that we have been dreaming about is truly based on a dream. It is not based on reality. And that is why I think we have to get realistic, which means getting radical. Now, I'm going to suggest one way to think about this present that we're dealing with and help us with the future is to go back and think about the past. We use history to arrange the way we understand complexity. hopefully it will be useful to us today. And one of the ways I've been thinking about history is to think of what I would call the three most important revolutions in human history: the agricultural revolution, the industrial revolution, and the delusional revolution. The agricultural revolution dates back about 10,000 years ago when human beings, a gathering hunting species, first figured out how to cultivate plants for food. And there were two crucial things that result from that. One is ecological, the other is political. Ecologically, the invention of agriculture kicked off an intensive human assault on natural systems. By that, I don't mean that gathering hunting people never did damage to a particular ecosystem, but the large-scale destruction we cope with today has its roots in agriculture, in the way that human beings have systematically exhausted the energy-rich carbon of the soil. And this is what Jackson would call the first step in the entrenchment of a fundamentally extractive economy, an unsustainable economy. So human agricultural practices varied from place to place, but in general, human agricultural practices have never been sustainable, nor have the other extractive economies that arose from them. Meanwhile, politically, the ability to stockpile food made possible concentrations of power and hierarchy that were relatively unknown in gathering hunting societies. And again, it's not to say that prior to the agriculture that humans were not capable of doing bad things to each other, but the large-scale institutionalized oppression, as we understand it, really does have its roots in this agricultural revolution. Now, the Industrial Revolution, which comes in the last half of the 18th century in Britain, intensified the magnitude of that human assault on ecosystems and human beings' assaults on each other. It unleashed the concentrated energy of coal, oil, natural gas. It created a machine-based world, which has admittedly produced unparalleled material comfort for some. And whatever one thinks of the effects of that material comfort, and I think at best it's a kind of mixed story, the processes that produce that comfort are literally destroying the capacity of the ecosystem to sustain human life as we know it into the future. And in the present, those comforts produced by that are clearly not distributed in a fashion that is consistent with any meaningful conception of justice in any system, theological or secular philosophical system. So what this means is these first two revolutions have left us in a place where we live in a way that's in direct conflict with common sense and our own stated principles. So the question is, how did we get to this place? And I think the answer has something to do with what I want to call the delusional revolution, which is a term I use for the development of very sophisticated propaganda techniques in the 20th century, especially a very highly emotive and image-based advertising system that have produced in the bulk of the population, especially first world societies, a distinctly delusional state of being. And even those of us who try to resist it often can't help but be drawn into the delusion in certain ways. And as a culture, we end up collectively acting as if unsustainable systems can be sustained simply because we want them to be. If you think about it, much of the storytelling in this culture, storytelling is how we come to understand the world in so many ways, particularly the dominant storytelling institutions, which are the mass media, they all remain committed to maintaining this delusional state, and it becomes very hard to extract oneself from the story. So, in summary, looking at history, what I want to suggest is the agricultural revolution set us up on a road to destruction. The industrial revolution ramped up the speed as we careen toward that end, and the delusional revolution has prevented us from coming to terms with the reality of where we are and where we're heading. So that's the bad news. The worst news is that in the society I live in, the United States, there is considerable resistance to even discussing, to even putting these questions on the table. And in a sense, that's not surprising, because I go back to Wes Jackson, who has suggested that part of the problem is we are a species living, as he calls it, out of context. I think that's an important thought. Jackson always likes to remind audiences that human beings like us, the modern human with the big brain, we've been on the planet about 200,000 years. And that means these revolutions going back 10,000 years are only 5% of human history. So we're living in systems that we did not evolve in over the long term, and which we really haven't figured out how to adapt to in the short term. So realistically, again, we need to get on a new road if there is going to be a future. The old future, that road we imagined that we could travel, is gone. I think it's part of the delusion. So unless one accepts what I would describe as an irrational technological fundamentalism, technological fundamentalism meaning this idea that we will always be able to find high energy, high technology fixes to whatever problems we have. The fact is, and there are no easy solutions to these ecological and human problems. The solutions, if there are to be any, will come, I think, only through a significant shift in how we live and a dramatic downscaling of the level at which we live. And I say if because I don't think there's any guarantee there are, in fact, solutions. History does not owe us a chance to correct our mistakes simply because we would like one. So where does this leave us? I think this leaves us, or at least it leaves me, arguing for a joyful embrace of the truly awful place we find ourselves, right? Which may seem a little counterintuitive. Actually, it may seem a little psychotic, because why would one invoke joy in response to a recognition of these very awful circumstances? But I think, for me, it's just a recognition again of reality, of who I am and where I sit in the world. I'm part of that species living out of context, and I'm saddled with the mistakes of our history, not to mention no small number of my own mistakes. But I am still alive in the world. I think one can go forward with a kind of intellectual humility, with an awareness that you could be wrong at any given moment. In fact, the chances are you probably are wrong at any given moment, and still move forward based on some set of principles. I think I'm simply suggesting it's still a good thing to be alive, and that to be fully alive means to struggle, and to struggle joyfully. It doesn't mean one has to ignore the reality. I wake up every morning, borrowing a phrase from a friend of mine, Jim Copland, from whom I've learned quite a bit. Jim told me one day, this was right after 9/11, and he said, in the United States at least, everybody's talking about how everything had changed after 9/11. And my friend Jim said, nothing has changed for me. He said, before 9/11, I woke up every morning in a profound state of grief. And after 9/11, I wake up every morning in a profound state of grief. He said, nothing has changed. And I think that's true. But it's also still true that we live in a kind of creation that is joyful, that the mystery of it still produces that kind of joy, at least for me. So I suppose if thinking of maybe the sort of pop culture, the bumper sticker version of this is, life sucks, it's great to be alive. You can accept the apparent contradiction of that. All right, so in the title of this talk, and in references, I've been talking about crises, these multiple crises, and I have yet to really name them. And in part, I didn't start by naming them because I suspect as I've been talking, you've been sort of running through your own catalog of crises, how you understand the problems of the world. For me, I would organize them as perhaps a political crisis. The recognition that meaningful democracy, that is, a conception of democracy in which ordinary people have a role in the formation of public policy, is probably impossible in large-scale political units like the modern nation-state. There is an economic crisis, the brutal inequalities that exist now within, internal to every corporate capitalist economy, and between countries in a world that is dominated by that very predatory capitalism. And, of course, an ecological crisis, the fundamentally unsustainable nature of the systems and lifestyles that arise from those systems.
Radio EcoShock will be right back after 1 minute for station identification.
Future's gone. The old future's done and gone, never to return. There's a new way through the hills ahead. This one will have to earn. This one will have to earn. Future's gone, the old future's gone. We can't get to there from here. The old future's gone.
This is Radio EcoShock. We return now to a revolutionary speech from Robert Jensen, a tenured professor of journalism at the University of Texas, Austin. This major paper on activism was released and recorded by Radio EcoShock on August 8, 2008, in Vancouver, Canada. It was titled, "The Old Future's Gone."
But I want to suggest there's also another level of crisis, which I suppose we could call cultural or philosophical, and one that is perhaps not as tangible, but has a lot to do with the way, at least I understand, where we sit in the world today. And for me, that crisis is best identified by talking about the work I do on the feminist critique of pornography, which we'll talk about more tomorrow night. For about 20 years, I've been studying and involved in organizing around the pornography industry, which is shaped by patriarchy, white supremacy, and that very same predatory corporate capitalism. And the reason I think it's an important issue in part is I think it provides a kind of mirror onto the collective consciousness of the culture. So we live in a world in which large numbers of people, mostly men, derive intense sexual pleasure from images of cruelty and degradation toward women, often in an extremely racist context. A smaller number of people, again, mostly men, profit from this, and except for a few people on the margins, mostly rooted in feminism and other radical philosophy, there is no significant progressive critique of it in contemporary society. What I think pornography tells us is what the world looks like when there is no more empathy. Right? What a world looks like bereft of the fundamental values of compassion and solidarity, where there is no sense of shared humanity. I think many aspects of this world, I think of the world these days as being mass-mediated, mass-marketed, and mass-medicated. And it is a world that can slowly strip us of basic humanity in ways that I think make it very difficult to respond to these other crises. And that's one of the things I worry about. So, trying to bring this into focus and adding up these crises, based on my political activism, especially over the last decade, and my general sense of the state of the world, I now want to make just a few thoughts about political organizing, about strategy. Again, I make these with a fair amount of humility and no, you know, definitive statement. But I think they are things to think about. First of all, I think it's, again, reflecting on the conditions in the United States, it's almost certain that there will be no significant political change in the next year or two in the United States. The culture is simply not ready to face this kind of question. And that might suggest that it is not a time to go forward in the world proposing all-encompassing solutions, but in fact a time to kind of drop back and sharpen our own analysis and to try to engage in as much conversation as possible about these kinds of crises, which goes against the grain for activists, because activists like to act. You want to move in the world toward action. But there is also, I think, a need, and especially at this time and place, to try and deepen our analysis. The second claim I would make is that it's probable that there are no mass movements likely to emerge in the next decade in the United States that will force leaders or institutions to face these questions. A lot of people in the United States think that until conditions in the privileged societies get dramatically worse, people are going to be almost paralyzed, stuck in the inertia that comes from that privilege. That suggests that, to use the terminology of the old left, this is a time for cadre building, a time not to pretend mass movements are likely to emerge, but to bring people together who can be the core of such movements when political conditions do change, and I think they will. I think it's also plausible to suggest that the systems in place cannot be changed peacefully, and that the forces that have been set in motion through patriarchy, white supremacy, nationalism, capitalism, cannot be reversed without serious ruptures in the way we live. That would suggest to me that when we plan political strategies, for perhaps the best case scenario, we should not forget to prepare ourselves for something much worse. And finally, to be more upbeat, I see some people looking a little dour out here. So to be a little more upbeat, my final thought is that it's worth considering the possibility that our species, the humans with the big brains are in fact nothing more than an evolutionary dead end, right? Which I say actually not to add to the depressing moment, but to realize that that is within the realm of the possible. And it doesn't mean that you stop working. It just means you recognize the world we're in. So, I am going to end upbeat, of course. Every talk has to end with hope. So, and I kind of want to end by celebrating human beings, which may sound a little odd given the kind of relentlessly grim nature so far. But I do think there's a way to kind of put a perspective on this that is actually, for me, rather heartening. And I'll go back to Wes Jackson, who never shies away from naming the nature of these problems. He's a very blunt fellow. But he also always reminds us that we should probably go easy on ourselves, because he suggests we're trying to do something that no species has ever had to do, which is to self-consciously limit ourselves in this quest to extract the energy-rich carbon from the world. And that is no small task, to self-consciously impose limits on an entire species. And if one recognizes the task at that level, then it's almost certain we are bound to fail. But we have to take those failures in, I think, that context. And I think they're easier to accept and therefore easier to potentially overcome if we recognize three things. Number one, we are animals, right? That we have these considerable rational capacities, but we are still animals driven by forces that are never fully rational and cannot be completely understood by anyone. Second, we are tribal animals. That is, whatever political units we live in today, our evolutionary history is essentially tribal. And we were designed, in evolutionary terms, to live in small groups. Some would say groups of probably no more than 150 people. Finally, we are tribal animals living in a global world. That the past 10,000 years of human history, and especially the past 500 years of imperialism and colonialism, have left us dealing with these human problems on a global scale. We can't avoid that. So even if our future is a return to life at a much more local level, as many people think it will be, and I would tend to agree, at the moment we also have a moral obligation, especially those of us living in more privileged sectors, to deal with the realities of the past 500 years, in which considerable wealth has been extracted from one portion of the world to enrich another, especially the portion of the world I live in. So what does all this mean in practice? In practice, I think what it means is that we essentially have to adopt a two-track strategy. And in some ways, there's nothing new in this. The first strategy has to deal with committing some of our energy to rectifying the crimes of the past 500 years, especially those of us who do live with the privilege that comes in societies like the United States. So I look at myself, I'm a middle-class, white, American male with considerable privilege, and there's plenty of places to go to work. Movements that are trying to end patriarchy, white supremacy, economic domination, U.S. wars of aggression around the world. There's no shortage of places to put one's energy in that track. But I also think that, as many have argued for quite a long time, there's also important work to be done in experiments to prepare what we will need for this new future that we can't really describe yet. That is, whatever the limits of our predictive capacity to understand the future, I think we can be pretty sure that we are going to need new ways of organizing ourselves, or ways of organizing ourselves that harken back to some old wisdom. And that's going to be necessary because we're going to live, among other things, in a world with far less energy and far fewer material goods. So that means we're going to need technical skills that, to a large degree in the first world, have atrophied. And I mean very literally skills such as gardening, food preparation and storage, and just the ability to tinker. Right? There's been an incredible atrophying of those abilities in a very short amount of time, actually in my lifetime. But I also think we're going to need not only skills, but stories, a sense of community, a sense of what it means to be human that has been largely destroyed in this very predatory system we live in. The stories we tell in this culture today are mostly about what it means to be a consumption machine, That's the story of capitalism. And we're going to have to find ways to tell different stories about ourself, about our sense of self, about our connection to other people, and about our connection to the non-human world, because the stories we tell matter. So in addition to the political organizing that we might be most familiar with, movements aimed at fundamental conditions of injustice, I think we also have to think about what are the skills and stories we're going to need, and how are we going to build those capacities. So in my own life, just to be very concrete, I continue to put some energy into those traditional movements. But I also have started to shift a lot of my energy to attempt to build local networks, because I think these experiments are always going to be local. So in Austin, we're starting to work on some worker-owned cooperative businesses that will be the nucleus of a social center that will bring, we hope, bring people together across boundaries and in different kinds of ways. And it isn't that there is an approved list of projects that we can hand out to everybody. These are the things you should be doing. People have different talents and temperaments. People are going to be drawn to different kinds of activities. I think all I'm suggesting is that we think about both of those levels of action and go wherever our hearts and minds might take us. So, you know, I started this talk with a warning about arrogance, so I'm not about to pretend that I have, you know, the answer to what people should do. But I do think it is abundantly clear that whatever it is, it's going to take a considerable amount of work. So I'll conclude where I started, which is with this lovely song called Old Future by John Gorka. And in that song, he tells us, the old future's dead and gone, never to return. There's a new way through the hills ahead, this one will have to earn. And I think there's something really profound in that, the idea that there is a way through, at least the possibility of a way through. But in a world where many of us have gotten very used to living very comfortably without working very hard at all, those of us who do come from this most privileged sector, that whatever the truth of how we are going to make our way forward, it's going to take a whole lot of work, and probably more work than we've ever had to do before. So that's some ideas, admittedly rather vague, sometimes not perhaps terribly clear, but at least I think the basis for a discussion about how folks are thinking about the problems and constructing their own solutions. So with that, floor is open. Thank you.
That was Dr. Robert Jensen from the School of Journalism at the University of Texas, Austin. His talk was The Old Future's Gone, Progressive Politics in Cascading Crises and the Struggle for Strategy. Robert Jensen, a Texas journalism professor more known for his work on feminism and pornography, although he's been widely published on all aspects of activism and the public scene. After the talk, given August 8, 2008, in Vancouver, Jensen renamed his paper to The Delusion Revolution, We're on the Road to Extinction and in Denial. So many of the scientists I interview right here on Radio EcoShock are telling me the same thing. Let's listen to some of the reaction from the activists attending Jensen's presentation.
For political activists, it's kind of a perennial debate as to how much energy one should expend in the existing political framework. And right now, of course, in the U.S., there's lots of people, should we support Obama? Should we vote for Nader? Mm-hmm. What do you think about that?
Well, that one I actually think is pretty simple. There's nothing wrong with voting. I vote in every election, you know, in the U.S., but it's a real mistake to imagine at this point that that's a meaningful political act. I've been saying my standard response to the Obama question is this is a historic election that's completely trivial. It's historic because for many of us, I was born in 1958. I never expected to see a person of African descent as a meaningful presidential candidate, meaningful meaning viable in a major party. And in that sense, it's historic. I mean, the United States at one point in my lifetime was an apartheid society, right? It was a society that was on a par with South Africa in terms of its racial ideology. And in that lifetime, we have a person of African descent who may well be, and in fact, unless there's a dramatic shift, will be the next president. And that's not a that is a truly historic moment. It's also trivial because Barack Obama brings with his campaign no commitment to anything that could be called change. And that's why he's the candidate of change, because he has no change on the agenda, right? It's the total, you know, emptiness of American politics at this point. My stand, you know, I have lots of friends who are liberal Democrats, and I always say, you know, there's nothing wrong with voting for them, but it's like the animals at the zoo. You don't feed them. You don't give them money. You don't give them your time. You don't give them your energy. Go vote for them. I mean, I would rather see Barack Obama president than John McCain. You know, I'd rather see this bottle of water president than John McCain. That's not saying much, right? But the illusion that Barack Obama is somehow a closet radical and he's going to, you know, get elected and then, you know, reshape American politics is truly delusional. It's the same delusion people had about Bill Clinton in 1992, and all that did was pave the way for a more reactionary politics. So on that level, I think it's pretty clear that if one has truly left feminist critical politics, the electoral arena is not the arena to be playing in, right? That there are other places to work. For me, then, it's a question of whether traditional social movements, like building the anti-war movement in the United States, is a meaningful place to put energy, or are there other places in these more community-building exercises? There, again, I don't think I would pretend to know enough to tell people what to do. The anti-war movement, I have long ago stopped contributing significant energy to the formal anti-war movement because I don't think it's going anywhere and I don't think it can go anywhere in the contemporary context. There are other movements I still try to contribute to. But a lot of this is, let's face it, it's a crapshoot. You know, you're working on hunches. The idea that you know, somebody can step back and plot, you know, you should put 72% of your time into the anti-empire movement, 14% into the anti-racist movement, you know, I just don't think that's the way the world works. I know that my gut tells me that at this particular point in my life, when I'm older, I have some resources I can leverage. I want to put those into things that I think would otherwise go unfunded, for instance. And that means reaching out to younger people in my community who have great ideas. This social center idea I was talking about, it's mostly folks in their 20s and early 30s, which seems very young to me. And if they're willing to let me be part of that, that seems a reasonable thing for me to do. But, you know, in the end, we're all making it up as we go along at this point, and that's part of what I'm trying to argue.
But I don't want to trash transnational movements totally. I mean, which is, you know, you kind of let's look at the local. Let's go back and create our own garden. You know, a little Candidean. You know, let's go back to Candide. And I'm just not sure that we need to go that far into the local when we think about this. I mean, because we don't. So we can say that February 15th and 14th and that period was unsuccessful in its kind of impact on Bush, but it was a great rehearsal for something, and I think we shouldn't just cut it off for that point. And I mean, the people I know in Asia who were part of it in the Philippines and in Japan who talk about it as a really great experiment that got hatched at the World Social Forum to see if they could do it, and it all happened. And they thought, well, we did this once, we might be able to do it again. So I think that we need to think about that also as one of your experiments that we talk mm-hmm. about. And secondly, you know, my work is on transnational social movements, and you know, there have been a lot of effects of these movements around the world. The violence against women's movement since 1975, and we can see how really change has happened on a global level with particular kind of movements like this. And when you talk about cascade, actually, it made me think of what Catherine Sikink talks about as justice cascades, which are the whole TRCs, the Truth and Reconciliation Commission, the way in which this notion of justice, transitional justice, has occurred in different ways that it had occurred since, you know, in World War II. So we have had particular kind of frameworks that have shifted that aren't necessarily radical, but they are different. And I think that we need to kind of think about that whole kind of piece that you speak about.
Can I respond real quickly?
Yeah.
I don't want to give the impression that I thought that work is irrelevant. In fact, it's just the opposite. I think it's incredibly important, especially when you live in a society like the U.S., which is so insular. Anything that breaks people out of that notion that the world is defined by what we do in the U.S. is crucial. I agree completely. I'm just suggesting that there are other levels at which we have to work. And again, people will have, you know, some people are going to gravitate toward one kind of work more than another. I know people who really should never be let out in front of other human beings, right? They're very useful and they work hard, but, you know, we're not all good at everything, right? People have suggested I should probably stay home more. But so, yes, I agree. It's not either or. And I think one of the, you know, really exciting parts of the last decade or two has been those connections made across boundaries. You know, the work around the WTO in Seattle that John and I were talking yesterday, was sort of undermined by 9/11, and that movement didn't sustain itself in some ways. But those were really exciting developments and really important. So, yeah. So I agree in that sense.
And then just to finish off, one piece is dystopia that you speak of. I actually think that Octavia Butler's work and her work on Parable of the Sower, where she constructs L.A. in 2025 as a world without oil, and all the freeways is now tracks of people walking. It's just an incredible dystopia that seems really possible, and is actually to your point about the local. Is, I think, where we should begin imagining those conversations.
I agree, and I'll give three book recommendations. One is the author you mentioned, Octavia Butler, who wrote a two-book set called, first one was called The Parable of the Sower, and the second was The Parable of the Talents. The second one, not as good. I actually taught The Parable of the Sower, which is she's considered a science fiction writer, although she's really not bound by the genre in that way. I taught that book recently to a first-year seminar, 15, 18-year-olds. This is a book about what happens when it all falls apart, and it's very grim. And I took a chance on teaching it, and I thought they're going to hate me. It was the book they loved, right? Because these 18-year-old kids coming from the suburbs of Dallas and Houston have some recognition somewhere that everything they've been taught their whole lives is utter and complete nonsense. And this book spoke to them. It's really powerful. And the hero is an 18-year-old African-American woman who's really just a phenomenal sort of character. So Octavia Butler is one of them. The more grim version of this is Cormac McCarthy's The Road, which I also recommend. It's a phenomenal book. It's being made into a movie that's going to be out soon as well. And then the third one is James Howard Kunstler, who, again, I often find his political analysis lacking. But his analysis of the energy situation in a book called The Long Emergency, if you just ignore the political stuff, is, I think, very compelling and very accessible for people like me who aren't scientists. He also just published a novel called World Made by Hand, which is not a great piece of fiction, but it imagines in a context of upstate New York, a post-oil world when the structures we're talking about have literally fallen apart. And it's not that any one of these is a roadmap to the future, but they do force us to think, what are we going to be doing at that point? And I think they're really fascinating, and they really are imaginative in the positive sense of that. So, Cormac McCarthy's book is called The Road. It won the Pulitzer Prize a couple of years ago. Well, there's several thoughts. Number one, I don't want anything I've said to suggest that I think people should stop doing things. I mean, I make a fairly decent living now, and I'm tenured. If I wanted to stay drunk and watch cable TV 24 hours a day, I could do it. Right? I mean, and I spend most of my free time working politically. I think it's where we find meaning.
So I want to
really emphasize that. The message is not that there's no hope. It's just, I think we work most effectively when we work within a realistic, you know, view of the world. You mentioned the sort of the long history of resistance to capitalism and other hierarchies. I think that's very important. It's very important to tap into it. It's also very important to realize when strategies and rhetoric has to change. So, for instance, I don't ever refer to myself in public as a Marxist, as a socialist, even an anarchist, even though in some ways all of those, you know, historical schools of thought inform what I do. I talk about being anti-capitalist precisely because those other terms don't mean anything in the U.S. right now, or what they mean is so distorted they're useless. I don't hesitate to talk about being against capitalism. One of my favorite talks I did was, you know, I think I called it something like anti-capitalism in 10 minutes or less. Right? And all I said is, listen, you can go to ordinary people and you can make three obvious points. Capitalism is inhuman, anti-democratic, and unsustainable. It's inhuman because it's based on a conception of human nature that says we are nothing but self-interested, greedy maximizers, right? Which is true. We are that. We're also compassionate and humane. So you've fashioned a philosophy that tells you that you're the worst kind of person you can be. It's anti-democratic because whatever capitalism is in theory, in practice, it's a wealth-concentrating system. And when you concentrate wealth, you concentrate power. That's not hard to sell to people either. People look around at lobbying and campaign contributions. They say, yeah. And capitalism is unsustainable. It's not the only unsustainable system that's ever been, but it is unsustainable. It's based on a notion of unlimited growth. And look around, it's a finite planet. Right? And if you talk about it in that way, people kind of nod. It doesn't mean they're immediately converted to the left, but there are ways to do this. And it's about constructing a narrative, I agree. It's about telling a certain story of how to understand the world that responds to the reality of the world we live in. The only thing I think I probably disagree with, I don't think there are any radical people in the corporate world, because the corporate world is not it's not about the individual people, it's about the nature of the system. And at some point, everybody in the corporate world is going to have to make a decision about how to maximize profit or not. And those people that do not maximize profit will be pushed out. So I think anybody with a real understanding of the nature of the struggle we're in may have a day job in the corporate world. I have lots of friends who have day jobs there. But I don't think the corporate world is a vehicle for any change. It is, in fact, an impediment to them. And I think we do have to verbalize that. And that's important right now because people like Paul Hawken and these folks are running around talking about green capitalism and how the market is going to produce the innovation that will get us through the end of cheap oil. I think that's utterly ridiculous. And I think those people have to be denounced. Right? I mean, I like to denounce Paul Hawken whenever I can. It's that sort of technological fundamentalism, market-driven notion. And I don't think there's any historical evidence of that, nor do I think theoretically it's even possible to imagine.
That was just a sample from more than an hour of questions and answers between Vancouver activists and Texas University professor Robert Jensen. It followed his speech, "The Old Future's Gone," recorded by Alex Smith of Radio EcoShock in Vancouver, August 8, 2008. You can download this talk and the Q&A session from the speeches section of ecoshock.org. Just look for the audio on demand menu on the main page of ecoshock.org for these free MP3 downloads. Jensen's paper and this audio were published all over the internet, including on ZNet, Alternet, and rebroadcast by the syndicated American program Unwelcome Guest. Later, Robert Jensen renamed it The Delusion Revolution, We're on the Road to Extinction, and In Denial. Personally, I do not think the age of mass movements is over. If Jensen thinks American privilege and shopping binges need to end first, well, the latest earthquakes on Wall Street might hasten that day. In coming Radio EcoShock shows, we'll hear from other well-known figures who still believe that an active people can reshape not just the government, but our whole society. We are on the road to extinction, but we may still turn around before the final crash. Join us on that journey, won't you? I'm Alex Smith. Robert Jensen's latest book is Getting Off, Pornography and the End of Masculinity from South End Press. To find his website, just Google University, Texas, Robert Jensen. That's J-E-N-S-E-N. And thanks so much for listening.
So kiss the joy as it goes by, Poet Williams said, like the poet said. Future's gone. Future's gone.
From the album Old Future's Gone, you've just heard singer John Gorka.
Future's gone. The old future's gone.